public hearing mode. Representative Williams, you are present, and if you'd like, we can either get you on first or redeem the time, or you can sit here.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
If that's
fine with me. If that's okay with you and your committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm State Representative Max Williams, House District 35, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here to share with you a few comments on House Bill 3630. This is a bill that the House Judiciary Committee took a considerable amount of time on as part of our overarching discussion that we had on the House side about the issues involving medical malpractice liability, insurance premium rates, and the malpractice issue. This proposal was initially brought forward in sort of a rudimentary form by the governor and the governor's office, and by the folks at the Department of Business and Consumer Services. And Ms. Streisinger is here today, and I'm going to leave a lot of the discussion about the detail of the operation of the bill to her and to the other experts that you'll hear from. I thought I'd share with the committee this point. We worked in a work group where I somewhat operated as the moderator in an effort to find a compromise on this bill, and we were successful in achieving that compromise where the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, the Hospital Association, the insurers, the department, all came to an agreement around this bill and its definition. I want to put on the record first that this bill is not a solution, a long-term solution to our medical malpractice liability coverage issues. It is not that, and I want you to understand that I don't believe that it is. What it is a short-term solution to a critical problem that we have in primarily rural Oregon, where access to health care, particularly health care related to obstetrics and the delivery of babies, is becoming a serious crisis for Oregonians in their access to health care coverage. This bill essentially captures a source of revenue that would otherwise have been paid in a premium tax payment. It allows SAFE to use that through a mechanism of a broadly defined concept of reinsurance that allows a premium relief to rural doctors, rural using the same definition that we use in the rural health care tax credit, to rural doctors in a level of relief that would provide premium relief to about 1,000 physicians throughout Oregon practicing in those rural areas. The relief would break down somewhere in the neighborhood of around 80% premium relief to doctors that are specializing in obstetrics, 60% relief to family practitioner types who are also delivering babies, and then 40% relief to every rural physician in another specialty or in another area of general practice throughout rural Oregon. The definition of rural, as I indicated, is the one that is used by the Office of Rural Health for the Rural Health Care Tax Credit. It is essentially population centers of 30,000 or less than 30,000. They'll provide you, if you haven't already received it in your briefings before the hearing, with a map that will give you an idea of where that impact will occur. But it covers a substantial part of rural Oregon. There were a number of conversations that occurred in the House Judiciary Committee, which I also believe that you'll end up having in this committee, Mr. Chairman. I want you to know that we fully vetted those conversations, and they included discussions of whether or not to include a broader involvement for oversight by the legislature of SAFE, which, as you know and I know, has been a perennial issue not only in this legislative session but in other legislative sessions. The committee listened to that testimony and presentation and considered it thoughtfully, and amendments were put forward which were rejected by a majority of the committee, and the bill passed out of committee without those amendments unanimously. I'll also tell you that the bill passed the House floor unanimously without those amendments. And it's not because a majority of the committee felt that some SAFE oversight by the legislature would be inappropriate. I think the committee felt that tagging this bill with that controversial issue would be problematic in its long-term future, and that the committee's goal was to find a methodology to assist rural Oregon and physicians practicing in rural Oregon with this mechanism, and that it was sufficiently important not for that to become the overriding discussion around this bill as it moves through the process.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Representative Williams, could I interrupt you for a moment on that point? Because I think that's an important point. Why do you say that tagging this bill with that controversial issue would be problematic for its long-term future? What makes you think that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, well, one, because of the lobbying interests that would be actively involved in that issue, which by that very nature I think would create potential problems. And secondly, in conversations with the governor's office, which suggested that there might be a long-term future problem for this bill were those amendments made.
Well, Representative, I guess we're going to be having that discussion this morning because I had such an amendment this morning, and I understand you had that discussion on the House side, but I wasn't a member of that committee, and I'm interested in hearing further more about what those long-term problems would be.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, it wouldn't be for me to suggest that this committee not have that discussion, but I felt it important for the committee to understand that we did entertain that discussion on the House side and what the result of that discussion was by the consideration of both the House Judiciary Committee and the full House when the bill came to the floor.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the last point that I'll raise that I'll offer for the committee's consideration is that House Bill 3630, when it came to the Senate, was assigned a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. You'll have a fiscal impact statement, a revised fiscal impact statement in your packets. I had some conversation. This came as a surprise to me when the bill came to the Senate. I had conversations yesterday afternoon with the Legislative Fiscal Office about the methodology for preparation of the fiscal statement, and they used a standard methodology they use anytime there's a task force associated with this bill or with a bill. And I need to point out, along with the relief that this bill provides, what it does in the long term to address the long term issue is a much needed professionally based task force of six members to work with an actuarial firm over the next 2 years to provide a balanced and unbiased report to the legislature on actuarial matters related to the medical malpractice insurance crisis. I think that's perhaps it's one of its most salient features. And to staff that committee, the House committee chose to have it staffed by someone out of Legislative Committee Services. So the Legislative Fiscal Office prepared a fiscal, which they prepare anytime Legislative Committee Services is asked to staff a committee. And you'll see at the top of that fiscal a $99,276 amount. If you read the text of that, what they'll tell you is that that is a cumulative amount. That is not the amount that they actually anticipate this committee or this task force to actually spend. They used an assumption that this task force would meet five times because the individual in committee services would not be actually doing the drafting of the report, but would merely be handling the administrative and scheduling activities of the task force. The actual impact would be substantially less than this $99,000 number that was put in the report. I urge them to revise the statement to demonstrate what the actual cost would be. They thought that that violated their policy that they've been using throughout this legislative session, but I would suggest to you that the $99,000 number at the top of that fiscal is a misleading number. Mr. Wiles from Committee Services is here in the room, and should it be the committee's pleasure, I would encourage you to ask him to come forward to talk about what the actual anticipated cost of staffing this task force would be. Using the same assumptions that Legislative Fiscal Office used, Mr. Wiles from Committee Services believes that this would constitute less than 6% of one person in Committee Services time during the interim to staff these five particular meetings. So the actual number for the impact to the legislative administration's budget would be substantially less than the $99,276, and I'd suggest to the committee that given the small amount that it would actually be in cost to legislative committee services, that the bill ought not warrant a referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and to the extent the committee thinks that you have actions that I understand you're able to take. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to answer any other questions and then let you get to discussing the details of the bill with the folks that were involved in putting the compromise together.
Thank you, Representative Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The problem is just really a terrible problem in rural Oregon, and I've watched as the particularly the OBGYNs and the surgeons have backed away from practice. It's just made it virtually impossible to find good access to prenatal and natal care in many rural communities. So the concept of this bill is great. I really appreciate finding at least even a temporary solution to this issue. But I'd like to ask Representative Williams through the chair, what's the nexus? I'm certain you folks discovered or disclosed or really tried to explore the concept of why it is that this agency should be charged with this particular duty at this particular time. So could you talk a little about the nexus between workers' compensation insurance and medical malpractice?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrelly, the nexus comes in part, I think, and I recognize that for some it's a bit of a stretch on the nexus, but I think it comes in part at least through the fundamental oversight of this issue through the Insurance Division as part of the Department of Business and Consumer Services. Beyond that, I think the nexus relates to SAFE as a instrument of the state in providing a type of insurance to those who is SAFE originally started as the State Accident Insurance Fund as sort of the insurer of last resort. I think at least in the initial public mission there was a nexus, and to the extent that SAFE still acts as an instrument of the state and an instrumentality of the state to address issues that matter to Oregonians that have an insurance relationship, I think it's as close a nexus as any other nexus you find within any other instrument of the state without having to create an entirely new institution in order to address it. That coupled with the fact that the capture of the premium payment can be done through the Department of Business and Consumer Services seemed to me to create a sufficient enough nexus with the governor's introduction of the idea, and with very few other options on the table to legitimately address this problem with rural Oregon, those things combined, I believe, satisfied my sense and the committee's sense, and a unanimous vote in the House, the House's sense, that there was sufficient nexus.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. It sounds, the logic's a little tortured, but SAFE is in fact in the insurance business, and DCBS does have the mechanisms, and medical malpractice insurance is obviously a need. There's a reserve and a funding source, and the mechanism is there. I think we're going to have clear in our minds why these things are connected. It isn't just an opportunity of convenience, although some people will certainly see it as that. The questions that I think people will legitimately ask this is, well, why not 911? Workers get injured, and they call 911. So why don't we fund 911 out of SAFE reserves? So I think we can.
Great idea.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrelly, given the 911 reserves, I was thinking, why not we fund the medical malpractice out of the 911 money? Right.
Bad idea.
The point I guess I'm just trying to make here is that we should be at least able clearly to articulate how these things do connect. And if they don't connect, we ought to recognize that they don't connect. In this case, I think the need is so clear. And we've lost so many services, and people are finding that they are, in fact, transferring these risks directly to emergency services, because people that don't get good prenatal or neonatal care end up in emergency hospitals and very serious health problems. So, but if you're convinced, Representative Williams, that there is a good nexus between this insurance mechanism and the need for medical malpractice, and DCBS is the right agency, then I think that is the thing that I will certainly stand on to try and explain this to others. And I'll say that Max Williams said it was a good idea. So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Farrell.
Established a record as to why he thinks that, too.
Exactly.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good luck with your hearing today.
Thank you. All right, I've got signed up first, Karen Whitaker.
Smack you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm pleased to join you today to urge your support for House Bill 3630. As many of you already know, and as Senator Farrioli already remarked, rural health systems are fragile and the healthcare workforce is not stable. Many areas of our state do not have adequate access to primary and obstetrical care, and the increase in malpractice insurance premiums has contributed to an even more serious situation in many communities. Our office's experience with recruiting and supporting rural doctors has led us to the conclusion that doctors who are willing to locate in rural communities are rather special people. They generally work longer hours, they see more patients, they earn less money than their urban counterparts. They practice medicine in an environment where there are more poor people, more elderly, and more uninsured patients, making the demand for their services high and their compensation low. Their spouses may not be able to find jobs, and their children may go to school in a district where there is a 4-day school week. Our survey data show us that their earnings for rural physicians are $20,000 to $30,000 lower per year than earnings for their urban counterparts. And while the rural lifestyle is what attracts them to a rural practice, they most often leave because of financial considerations. These conditions begin to explain why we have chronic shortages of physicians in rural areas and why our office continually looks for ways to improve access to health care for rural Oregonians. Certainly House Bill 3630 is one way to accomplish that goal. I've brought with me some information that illustrates the status of the current physician workforce in rural Oregon as a way of looking at House Bill 3630 in some context. And the colorful, mostly blue map that's attached to my testimony categorizes Oregon in four categories. The very blue counties are frontier counties where you have less than 6 people per square mile. The sort of green counties are those where every place in the county matches our definition of rural. The sort of tan color have a mixture of urban and rural communities. And then the one red county, Multnomah County, is the only county in the state that has not one community in it that meets the definition of rural.
That's an appropriate color for that county, too.
Yes, okay, thank you. I've walked you through this because I've analyzed the most recent physician workforce data in this manner, and the table that is just following my testimony compares physicians in Oregon by area from 1998 to 2002. And it shows that the areas that are most rural are the ones, of course, that have the fewest physicians. But rather than wade through these numbers, I've made two graphs that are on the next page. The first one addresses ratios of physician to population, and that's these graphs here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
There's another way to categorize this one. The blue ones belong to me, and the other colors belong to everybody
that's
else.
That's true. That is true, isn't it?
Except for Fort Hand.
All right.
The first one addresses ratios of physician to population. And in frontier counties, for example, the ratio of physicians to population in 1998 was 1 to 846. In 2002, it was higher, 1 to 906. Now, in this model, the lower the number, the better, so you don't want high numbers. And the conditions have actually worsened between 1998 and 2002 in those very frontier counties. In Multnomah County in 2002, the ratio was 1 to 199, which means that wherever you go in Multnomah County, if you have 200 people, one of them is going to be a physician. And, of course, Multnomah County serves other than just Multnomah County population, so that's a little bit misleading. But it is important to point out that the availability of physicians in frontier counties has worsened and that our one urban county was the biggest winner between 1998 and 2002. The second chart looks at the data in a slightly different way, and in this model we want the numbers to be high, not low, and there are currently 1.1 physicians per 1,000 population in frontier counties and 2.39 per 1,000 in rural counties. And again, the data show losses for frontier counties. In urban counties. Again, the data show losses for frontier counties and very small gains for rural and mixed counties. And these losses occurred prior to the current crisis in malpractice insurance premiums. We don't have the 2003 data yet, so we only have anecdotal accounts of physicians leaving their rural practices. And not all physicians are leaving their practices. Some are cutting back the types of services that they provide. You will hear ample data today to verify the rate at which rural physicians who provide or who recently provided obstetrical care are no longer delivering babies. And may I add just one observation. Many of these physicians are relatively young, and they practice in communities where there is not a demand for additional physicians. In fact, many of our rural communities are losing population, especially young families. That means that those communities who are losing obstetrical care now will likely not have any obstetrical care for the next 20-plus years, which, unless some intervention is devised. The final map I've included shows you what parts of the state would be affected under House Bill 3630, and according to our definition of rural adopted by the Office of Rural Health, and it's a simple definition, all geographic areas 10 or more miles from the centroid of a population center of 30,000 or more. We do have a very skilled data person in our office who, and this is a GIS map, so it's very accurate according to the 10-mile definition. And this map also acknowledges that there are degrees of rurality. I'd like to close by thanking you for considering the bill. Although it is not a permanent solution to the malpractice insurance crisis, it does offer temporary relief until more lasting answers are found, and I would be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Bree.
Thank you for your testimony. I think this is very informative.
Thank you.
Especially like the charts. In the past, there were incentives to draw doctors to rural communities. I think there was a federal program where their loans were forgiven, their government loans were forgiven. Could you just kind of briefly tell us the incentives that are still existing for rural physicians and what kind of difference those are making?
Sure. Chairman, Senator Burdick, there are a number of federal programs through the National Health Service Corps that benefit very underserved and rural parts of the state, not at all a general benefit for rural areas. We have, I think, 5 or 6 federal loan repayment candidates in Oregon right now. We also have a state loan repayment program, and we have 6 physicians currently on that program, and they must practice in areas of the state that have unmet health care needs according to the data that we use. We also have a state income tax credit for rural physicians, a $5,000 personal income tax credit that was passed in 1989. It doesn't go very far toward making up the differential of $20,000 to $30,000 income, but it certainly is a symbolic gesture on the part of the state that acknowledges the contribution those physicians are making, and I think it's a very valuable incentive for them.
Thank you.
All right. Any additional questions? Thank you, Ms. Whitaker.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. And Corey Streisinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3630A, which would implement the governor's proposal to reduce professional liability insurance premiums for doctors in rural areas. And I wanted to start by saying that, as Representative Williams remarked, there was a lot of participation by the stakeholders in this issue over on the House side. I really want to thank Representative Williams and all of the stakeholders who participated in that work. I think the bill before you is a stronger and better product than what we had come in with an initial proposal, and that's the product of a lot of creative thinking by all the folks who are involved in it. Ms. Whitaker has spent some time going over with you the background of this problem, so I won't repeat that. She mentioned the OHSU survey, which is showing a significant risk for the continued access to health care in rural areas, and in particular a significant number of people practicing obstetrics who are leaving that practice. And that obviously is sobering news for anyone concerned with the continued vitality of Oregon's rural areas and the economy in those rural areas. Without doctors and without obstetric care, it's very difficult for rural communities to attract attract families and build up a workforce. As Representative Williams remarked, the proposal we have for you today is not a long-term broad-based solution. There was a task force that looked at this set of issues over the interim. They came up with quite a number of proposed solutions, but I guess the one conclusion everybody involved in that task force would say to you is that there's no consensus on the long-term approach, and all of the solutions that were produced by that task force had, virtually all of them, had very strong opposition from several stakeholder groups. So the proposal that we have in front of you today is short-term and partial, but we do think it's an important first step and a way to buy us some time to look at more broad-based solutions. This proposal would reduce insurance costs for rural doctors through a reinsurance program to be administered by SAFE. The program would be offered to doctors in rural areas where access to medical services is most at risk. The goal is to deliver relief to all rural doctors, but as Representative Williams said, we have some tiered targets to focus higher rate relief for obstetricians and family practitioners who practice OB, because those are the doctors whose premiums are the highest. Often an obstetrician would need to pay insurance premiums in the range of $50,000, which could be six times as much as a general practitioner who doesn't offer OB. The numbers in the bill, 80% premium reduction for obstetricians, 60% for general practitioners who offer obstetrics, and 40% for all other doctors, we think are achievable, but I do want to mention that those are targets. They aren't commitments. We believe they can be achieved, and we will try our best to do that in structuring this program. The program is scheduled to begin on January 2004. The insurance would continue to be provided through the existing primary insurance carriers. In other words, doctors would continue to buy their insurance from the same insurers that they buy it from today. The reinsurance program would be administered by SAFE in agreement with those primary carriers. The bill does not set out the specific details of how the program would be delivered, because the details will need to be worked out by SAFE and the primary insurance carriers. So the bill requires SAFE to develop a plan for providing the program, which would be subject to review and approval by the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Office of Rural Health at OHSU. And program elements could include traditional reinsurance, under which SAFE would share the insurance risk and either retain some of the risk or transfer it through commercial reinsurance market, or it could include what's known as financial reinsurance, under which SAFE would participate financially in reducing insurance costs without itself retaining risk. And I should mention that you may see some proposed amendments from the reinsurance industry about how to structure the program, and I believe we have come up with some language that will satisfy their goals and also satisfy our goals with maintaining maximum flexibility in how this program is structured. We do want to have flexibility because the goal is to be able to deliver rate relief at those targets that we mentioned, and we can't tell you today precisely what the most effective way to do that is going to be. The bill will require that savings from the program be passed along to doctors purchasing the insurance. The cost of the program would be capped at an average of $10 million per year for 4 years. SAFE would be entitled to offset the cost against the assessment which it pays to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This assessment is paid by all workers' compensation insurers and self-insureds, and it's currently equal to 8% of workers' compensation premiums. The assessment goes into a premium assessment operating account, which funds the administration of our workers' compensation and OSHA systems. And for a number of reasons, recent collections have been higher than projected in this account. We are planning a decrease in the assessment for all workers' compensation insurers. We reported to the Ways and Means Committee earlier this year that we have projected the rate to go down from the current 8% to a planned 6.7%, and we do expect to be able to implement this rate decrease even with the offset for SAVE's cost of this reinsurance program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walsh.
Thank you. Ms. Streisinger, this is a real important point for me, and apparently it was for Senator Ferrioli, who's now left the room, but I need you to explain this premium assessment and where this money's coming from and why we have it. In the first instance, you said for a number of factors, more money has come in than expected. Could you please go into those, and why is there more money? Why hasn't it been returned to the policyholders, and how is it that we have this money to do this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the premium assessment, which is assessed to all workers' compensation insurers, is based on a long-term econometric forecast of the costs of administering the workers' compensation system in Oregon. The workers' compensation system and our OSHA system, which promotes workplace safety to keep the cost of workers' compensation low, receive no general fund support at all. They are funded through this assessment on workers' compensation insurance. The projections are long-term. They require looking at what we anticipate workers' compensation premiums to be, what we anticipate program costs to be. There's great desire by the workers' compensation insurance market to keep those costs relatively flat over time. That is, not to have them spike up, spike back down, and spike up again. The rate has been 8% for quite some time based on those long-term forecasts. Probably the most significant factor in causing collections to exceed projections most recently was September 11th. After September 11th, I believe as a result of a federal direction, there has been a surcharge on workers' compensation premiums to accommodate the risk of those types of large-scale workplace fatalities and injuries through terrorism. That because the assessment is 8%, when premiums go up, collections of that assessment go up. We take that into account and drop the assessment rate. But we want to drop the assessment rate to a level that will be sustainable over the long term. In other words, not have it drop and then have to spike back up to meet the long-term projected needs of the program. And therefore, the projected long-term drop is down from 8% to 6.7%. We try to manage that fund so that it meets financial parameters and does not build up a surplus. At the dropping that rate will keep a surplus from building up, but there is a bubble, essentially, which has built up, which can be used to fund this program.
So you believe that, sounds a little bit like the economic forecasting we do here at the state hasn't been so good lately, but I don't think that's any fault of the forecaster. But you believe that you can drop the premium assessment from 8% to 6.7% and still fund this program adequately.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct. And our economists tend to be quite conservative in how they project. So, yes, we do feel that is something we can do.
So sometime in the middle of this program, you don't expect it to run out of money and have to impose an additional assessment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, we don't. We have tried to, as I say, be conservative in our assessments to not run into that risk.
So you believe the $10 million is adequate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, we do. That the $10 million would be, in fact, a cap. SAFE would be required to develop a program that would not exceed that cost. They would not be entitled to a credit for any more than that amount, although that is an average annual amount because premiums, insurance premiums, do tend to increase over time. It may we would actually hope that the program cost would be less than that in the first year, so that there would be a potential to absorb some premium increase in later years.
And Ms. Dreisinger, the administrative cost to run this program, would it be at the cost that SAFE currently uses in administering its program? Would it be reduced, or what are we looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we do not expect very high administrative costs, and SAFE feels that those can be handled within its existing administrative resources.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But I think I want to make a point, too, that this assessment money is not part of the SAFE reserve issue that's kind of set aside. Is that correct or not?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
This is a separate pot of money that goes to fund OSHA and SAFE.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the net cost to SAFE does not have a net cost, program cost. SAFE will handle the administrative functions and will advance funds if needed, but will be able to recoup
those. I'm talking about the current assessment money, where that cash flows into the state system.
Yeah, that does not flow into SAFE's reserves.
All right, that goes into a different
correct
pot. So I'm going to make sure that you understand that there's, mm-hmm. There's a different pot of money here. So. All right, thank you.
As I mentioned, under this bill, the program would continue for 4 years. During that period, to look at the longer term, the bill proposes several activities. And first, the bill will set up a Blue Ribbon panel to oversee the work of an actuarial consultant to analyze and gather data on the medical professional liability market in Oregon. One of the frustrations that's been expressed by a number of people who've looked at this issue is the lack of good neutral data. There's a lot of data there, but often it is produced by or presented by proponents of a particular viewpoint, and the goal is to come up with an unbiased view of the factors affecting the market to enable the next legislative session to better evaluate long-term options for reducing the cost of medical liability insurance. The Blue Ribbon panel would have two members appointed by the governor, two by the speaker, two by the president of the Senate, and at least one appointee from each of those appointing authorities would have to have professional expertise in gathering, evaluating, and applying research data. The consultant would be hired by SAFE, but would, based on the advice of the panel, and the panel will establish the consultant's work plan and review its work. The consultant costs would be paid out of the fund that sets up this program, that is the same funding mechanism that we had talked about earlier. It would come out of that first year's costs with the cost capped at 2% of the anticipated first year amount, in other words, $200,000. Which the stakeholders who came up with this concept felt was a reasonable consultant expense to get a high-quality actuarial product. The work of that Blue Ribbon panel, then, will be focused on insurance costs statewide. The second study element of the bill will be focused on rural areas specifically, the Office of Health Policy and Research, and the Office of Rural Health, which Ms. Whitaker represents, are directed to make recommendations to the governor and the next legislative assembly concerning, in general, how to attract and retain doctors in rural areas. So this will be a more broad-based look, not focusing on insurance costs. We are also asking for the adoption of the -A7 amendments. I'd like to review those very briefly with you. They cover four separate concepts, the first one is to confirm the broad flexibility in designing the program. The amendments make explicit mention of the concept of financial reinsurance, which is the concept I mentioned earlier of financial participation in insurance costs without risk transfer. This is an option that was developed by the work group on the House side, and we have always intended the reinsurance language in the bill that's in front of you to be broad enough to include it, but several of the stakeholders have suggested that it would be useful to mention the concept specifically in the bill, so the -7 amendments do that. Secondly, in response to a question raised by the state treasurer, the -7 amendments, -A7, make clear that the fund established by this bill will earn interest and that interest will be credited to the fund. Third, the amendments clarify the maximum amount which can be paid to the actuarial consultant that I mentioned at that 2% of the anticipated first-year amount. And finally, in response to a suggestion by Senator Walker, the -A7 amendments would require my department to report to the legislature on the performance of the program. So I urge your support of House Bill 3630A and the -A7 amendments, and I'll be happy to answer any questions, and as will Mr. Davies from SAVE.
All right, Senator Walker.
Yeah, how'd you know?
I just learned to anticipate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Streisinger, for adding the Section 15 at my request. And, Committee, the reason I asked her to do that was because I didn't want to wait 4 years to get a report on how this program is doing. I think we need to know next legislative session how this program is doing. If it's working, then we can work on expanding the program whatever we need to do. So I thought it was important to do that. I have a serious question about the very first part of this amendment, however, on page 2, where you want to insert the words "by any appropriate coverage which may consist of financial reinsurance." You sort of breezed by that. Can you please tell me what you mean by that?
Yes, Senator Minnis, Senator Walker, the concept of financial reinsurance without that qualifier involves the transfer of risk. That is, SAFE would need to not only participate financially in the cost of insurance, but also take some of the risk from the primary insurance carriers and either retain that risk itself or transfer it further through purchased commercial reinsurance. And that is one of those are tools that we want SAFE to have available in designing this program. But it may be in consultation between SAFE and the primary insurance carriers that they find that it is more cost effective and can deliver additional, more extensive relief to rural physicians by financial participation, that is support of the premium cost without assuming risk. And we want to have that option available. That the distinction between the terms is that for accounting purposes, financial reinsurance would not be considered reinsurance. For insurance purposes, it is. That's why we wanted to have the phrase in there specifically so that nobody could say, well, under accounting purposes, you can't do this. None of the stakeholders are concerned with having this treated as reinsurance from an accounting standpoint.
Okay, well, I think there might be some people that might testify to that issue. Was that something that you discussed with the stakeholder group and that came out of that discussion?
Yes, Senator Minnis, Senator Walker, that was a proposal made by the stakeholder group. They felt that it was possible that if this were limited to traditional non-financial reinsurance, it could have higher than anticipated transaction costs that would result in less relief being able to be delivered. And one of the other amendments on the House side coming out of that work group, which you'll see in the bill, was to add in the factors to be considered in developing the plan, minimizing transaction costs.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Chris, you have...
Yes, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation. I'm here simply to add SAFE support to this program. We were asked by the governor and by DCBS to see if we could participate in helping to find this temporary solution. Our board of directors was concerned about not wanting to utilize or jeopardize workers' compensation funds, and this bill, the plan included in this bill, treats it as a completely separate activity, and because workers' compensation reserves are not involved in this plan, our board is supportive of it, and we will be working with DCBS to put together the plan and the details of the plan that the bill calls for. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
All right, any other questions? Okay. We'll move on. Thank you very much. Mr. DiLorenzo.
I leave it to John DiLorenzo to provide us with a notebook.
Are we going to read this?
probably an executive summary.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I promise you I will review the executive summary, not the voluminous materials that are being handed to you. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the Davis Wright Tremaine firm, and I am appearing here today on behalf of my client, Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, or OSEP for short. OSEP was formed in September 1997 by many of the members of the Class Action Steering Committee for what were known at the time as the ABC Roofing and the Allsea Veneer cases. Through their efforts, employers in this state received approximately $200 million, representing their share of pre-1982 industrial accident fund surplus accumulations, which had been appropriated for budget relief in 1982. I've marked on your list that I am appearing here today as a neutral party. We're appearing as neutral parties because we are not opposed to the concept that has been enunciated by the governor to afford relief, temporary as it may be, to help the malpractice insurance crisis in the state. We are, however, opposed to expanding SAFE's role to the medical malpractice field or in any other way in the absence of adequate oversight, adequate disclosure, or adequate accountability. Now, over the years, OSEP has had a significant interest in the management of the Industrial Accident Fund by SAFE and has on many occasions questioned the manner in which the surplus accumulations are determined and thereafter distributed. Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to testify before the Senate Committee on Transportation and Economic Development concerning the future of SAFE. The hearings generated many methodologies for resolving problems inherent in SAFE and many viewpoints concerning the future of SAFE, which culminated in a decision by a majority of the committee to support a process ultimately leading to the sale of SAFE. During those hearings, SAFE's desire to do business as a private company while remaining an agency of the state of Oregon was thoroughly discussed. The committee examined SAFE's agency status and its charge to make inexpensive insurance available to Oregon employers. The committee also heard testimony relating to how SAFE, the state agency, engages in activities which the legislature would never tolerate from any other state agency. In particular, the committee heard testimony that SAFE discriminates against among those it was created to serve, that it amasses political data concerning members of the legislature, that it lobbies and retains political consultants, and that it attempts to influence the legislature's thinking by expending significant money on legislative advertising for the purpose of influencing legislative opinion. Now, I'm appending a full copy of my Senate testimony, which is the blue book that's before you for your information. It is for many of these reasons that my client has great concerns with regard to the proposed expansion of SAFE's role to the medical malpractice area. If House Bill 3630 is adopted, SAFE will be charged with making many decisions in the absence of any meaningful oversight and in the absence of any opportunity for the public or the legislature to review that decision-making process. For instance, this bill permits SAFE to offer reinsurance coverage on such terms and conditions as SAFE deems reasonable. SAFE is required to develop a plan to not obligate SAFE to provide coverage at a cost that exceeds $10 million for each policy year. In Section 6, if an insurer reinsures with SAFE, the insurer must reduce premium charge to a physician, quote, in a manner that fully recognizes savings made available by coverage offered, unquote, under the Act. In fact, the A7 amendments, which you now have before you, go further. They provide that SAFE can adopt, quote, any appropriate coverage which may consist of reinsurance as an alternative to Section 1. Mm-hmm. Now, my client doesn't have a position concerning the A7 amendments, but it is important that you realize that the A7 amendments would allow SAFE to fully abandon the provisions of Section 1 and basically create whatever program it desires which may include reinsurance, but which need not. Well, SAFE management and its board of directors will make these and many other determinations which will ultimately result in the success or failure of this new enterprise,
which is now being proposed for Safe Corporation. Unfortunately, there will be no real way to know whether Safe Corporation is making these determinations in the public interest. That is because Safe Corporation has a history of refusing to disclose to the public information which the public needs to determine how its own insurance company is being managed and whether there exist surpluses which should otherwise be shared with policyholders or with the public at large. In February, I wrote each of you concerning my client's efforts to obtain records and information from SAFE and the manner in which, regarding the manner in which dividends were declared, how they're distributed, and other information which would allow employers to determine the true extent of the surpluses that are available in the Industrial Accident Fund. Over the years, SAFE has employed many tactics in order to resist disclosure of this information. In July of 2000, my client filed a lawsuit in the Circuit Court of Marion County demanding disclosure of many documents which SAFE wished to keep secret. In early 2001, the Marion County Circuit Court ruled that my client was entitled to inspect the secret documents at issue and further issued a declaratory judgment that the exceptions contained within the public records law were not applicable to these requests for this type of information. The court was of the view that SAFE could not deny the public's record requests or any portion thereof based on exemptions like trade secrets. Thereafter, SAFE appealed that case to the Court of Appeals. The case was recently decided in a unanimous opinion in our favor, fully vindicating the rights of the public and the members of the legislature to see these types of secret documents. Now, SAFE has indicated that it will seek review of this decision in the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals decision, however, led you as a committee to codify the decision in the Senate version of House Bill 3093, which you recently passed on the floor of the Senate. The House, however, has not concurred in your amendments, and we hope that your conference committee will refuse to eliminate these important provisions. We also ask that you consider placing the provisions that you put in House Bill 3093 in this bill, too. Now consider this example. Recently, representatives of SAFE distributed to some of you a document to show, quote, how SAFE performed exactly as the legislature intended during these difficult times, unquote. The document was an interoffice memorandum addressed to Catherine Keene, and I apologize for misspelling Ms. Keene's name in my formal testimony. I just noticed that. But it was from SAFE's marketing manager, and it generally analyzed market dynamics impacting Oregon small businesses. Of great interest was the statement that was contained at the top of the memorandum, and I have attached a copy of the top page of that to the last page of my testimony here. At the top of the memorandum, it read, quote, this memorandum is confidential and exempt from public disclosure pursuant to ORS 192501 to 192660. Well, you've got a copy of that first page to your testimony, but you can use that to witness firsthand the manner in which SAFE abuses the exemptions in the public records law to keep hidden documents which the public has every right to see. Now, the document which SAFE evidently designated as exempt from disclosure is a fairly innocuous one. It generally analyzes market trends, private carrier activity, and SAFE's role vis-a-vis other carriers. I can make a full copy of that document available to you should you request it. The document obviously is not the type which should be shielded from the public, not only by virtue of its content, but also by the fact that it was shared with many of you. Public agencies should not be permitted to deprive the public of access to their records merely by placing a stamp or a legend on them. Now, if SAFE is entrusted with the provision of reinsurance in the medical malpractice markets or under the A7 amendments with the ability to basically forge any program it wishes, whether it includes reinsurance or not, will it likewise assert trade secrets in order to keep its source documents and records of its activity in this arena away from public purview? Will SAFE be as unaccountable to you in this new arena as it has been in the workers' compensation arena? Will SAFE be permitted to make new contractual alliances for political purposes without your consent in this arena too? My client does not object to the governor's general approach to relieve medical malpractice, the medical malpractice insurance crisis which faces the state. In fact, we applaud his efforts. We do object, however, to entrusting this task to an operation which operates sometimes as a private company when it suits its purpose, sometimes as a state agency when it suits its purpose, and always under the cloak of secrecy. As I stated in my Senate testimony, the time has come for the legislature to decide whether SAFE is fish or fowl. If SAFE is intent upon operating as a private organization, then the state should mutualize it or sell it, and it should operate accordingly under the insurance code. If, on the other hand, it is to operate as an agency of the state, and if its charge is to be further expanded by virtue of this bill, then its operation should be conducted in the light of day, and it should cease and desist from its attempts to obstruct the public's right to know and its efforts to place political pressure upon your decision-making process. Further amendments guaranteeing oversight and accountability, like those contained in the A9 amendments, and public access to information, like those provisions which you have currently inserted in the Senate version of House Bill 3093, are a must if this agency's role is to be further expanded. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time that you've afforded me, and I am available to answer any questions which the committee may have.
All right. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
The SAFE amendment that we put in to House Bill 3093, in your view, does that solve the problem that you've had with disclosure from SAFE?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, in my view, provided that the amendment you inserted in that bill survives the conference committee, yes, it would alleviate our concerns, and it would fully vindicate the rights of the public, as have been confirmed by the Court of Appeals decision. My concern is that those amendments may not survive in the conference committee deliberations. Now, they may if your conference side holds pat, but given the fact that that bill does not otherwise concern SAFE, it concerns OHSU, there may be political pressures brought to the fore to delete that provision. If there is any chance in your minds that that provision is in jeopardy, I would ask that you merely clone it in this bill, where it truly belongs.
Thank you.
Right, other questions?
Yes.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for testifying this morning. I was wondering if you could spell out with a little more specificity what your concern is with the Dash A7 amendments, the language, by any appropriate coverage which may consist of financial reinsurance. What specifically are you concerned that SAFE may do? What are we open to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, first of all, I am not concerned about the policy inherent in the A7 amendments. I suspect the A7 amendments exist because there is not certainty as to whether reinsurance will do the trick. That is why I believe the amendment reads, by any appropriate coverage which may consist of financial reinsurance. What this amendment does is, frankly, allow SAFE to place any program in place that it desires, which may or may not include financial reinsurance. Now, that may be a good policy.
You said any program?
Well, let's take a look at where that would go in the bill. I think somebody handed out
page 2, line 13 on the.
Yeah, I mean, the way I read this references the program carried out under section 1 of the bill.
Hold on for a second. Page 2 of the Angels, line 13. Here we go. I am looking at page 2 of the Hand and Growth, A and Growth version, line 13, and it provides B, obligates the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation to carry out the reinsurance program established under Section 1 of this Act, or by any appropriate coverage which may consist of financial reinsurance. In other words, I read that as an opportunity for SAFE to abandon Section 1 and to substitute its own program if it wishes. Now, assuming that that is good policy, and it very well may be, my point is that SAFE should not have this broad authority without strict accountability to you and without public disclosure.
Yes, Senator Rico.
I don't think the word or is in there unless I'm missing something.
It's not.
It is not.
I think that the any appropriate coverage refers to carrying out the reinsurance program specified under Section 1 of the Act.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's true. It must carry out Section 1, but it may carry it out by employing any appropriate coverage which may consist of financial reinsurance.
That's true, but only with regard to the reinsurance program for this.
Right? I agree.
Okay.
But it's
okay.
The word any appropriate coverage and the word may that appears. Those are optional words.
That's fine. Right. Okay.
That's my point.
We're tracking.
Okay.
We're tracking.
Thank you.
Other questions, Senator Walker?
Yes, Mr. DiLorenzo, you talked about the amendment in 3630, which addresses the disclosure issue. My A9 amendment really talks about oversight. So that really is something separate and apart from disclosure, and I wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, I do agree. In fact, it was my position in my testimony that I believe we need adequate disclosure and public accountability. I believe the A9s, in my view, adequately address public accountability. What the bill does not yet address is adequate disclosure. Adequate disclosure can be brought about if the provisions that were inserted in the OHSU bill survive. But if they do not survive, I believe they have a place in this bill too, and I believe it would be very easy to merely clone them in this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
This is black, not blue. Am I correct? You said the blue notebook, and I just want to make sure I'm not colorblind.
You probably wrote it down in our notes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I confess that it is likely me that is colorblind.
Okay.
It looks blue to me, but it depends on the light.
Just wanted to be sure.
Ask him what color his suit is.
All right. Any other questions?
No.
No questions. Thank you, Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time you've afforded me.
All right. Mr. Gallen. Scott Gallen, Oregon Medical Association.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallen. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. We have worked with the administration on the governor's proposal from its initial concept and have tried to assist the department in enabling a broader amount of coverage and impact of the original legislation from our estimated 100 to 150 physicians in rural Oregon to slightly over 1,000. And in our discussions with the department and the two primary malpractice carriers, admitted carriers in the state, Northwest Physicians Mutual, a physician-owned and operated company and based out of Salem, Oregon, and CNA, we believe that the bill will enable the program to meet the premium reduction targets that are provided for in the bill. The importance, in our opinion, of the A7 amendments, particularly the language that you were just discussing, is that it does in fact enable the program, with the approval of the Office of Rural Health and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, to implement a program that will reduce premiums to the degree that the bill provides without necessarily going to a program where SAFE would take risk. And it's very important to understand why. There have been recent cases, for example, a very recent case, where the prayer was for $20 million. The final judgment was a mere $11 million. So if you think about the amount of funding that this legislation contemplates, you could essentially, under a reinsurance concept, if you retained that risk, essentially expend those resources in one case. We believe that you'll fundamentally end up with a program that is a insurer-to-insurer premium reduction process that does not expose SAFE or others to the risk that people have alluded to at the moment. So this is, as has been described, a short-term solution, temporary solution, for one area of the state, a large geographical area of the state, that is having particular problems in what we believe to be a statewide crisis on the of the delivery of services, medical care services, to Oregonians. And the reason we say that is, and we have sent materials to all of you over the course of the session, there are, in fact, physicians who are withdrawing from the provision of high-risk services in a variety of practices, whether it's neurosurgery, orthopedics, OB care, as you have heard in other areas, because of the concern of the exposure of individual liability of the practitioner who cannot get coverage that exceeds $5 million at any kind of cost-effective manner, particularly where you have a small number of cases that go well in excess of that sort of coverage. So in order to protect themselves, essentially, physicians are making decisions on trying to reduce their exposure to risk. And that's having an impact on the ability of patients to have access to high-risk services. The issue, the secondary issue, I think, that was just presented to you is a fascinating one, but one that we don't believe should, in fact, be introduced into this bill. As you've heard, it is already lodged in another bill that is going to conference. There are obviously other options that the legislature might take. For example, a legislator could introduce a priority bill, if they have any left, to address the issue directly and solely on whether or not SAFE should have particular oversight, as has been described. And it's not really necessary to have a safety valve amendment in this particular vehicle, as important as we believe it is in the process. In regard to the longer-term review of the liability problems in Oregon, we think it is critically important that we set up a mechanism, objective as we can make it, to analyze what the market is doing at the moment, what kind of impact it's having on patient access to medical services, and what kind of impact it is having on things like trauma services, emergency services, and the availability of those services and practitioners in delivering those critical medical needs. While we do have a particular viewpoint on what we believe would have a positive impact on stabilizing malpractice rates and the climate in Oregon, I don't think we'll get into that. I think that will, in fact, be one of the tasks of the task force. But I think everyone believes that it is fair to evaluate all reasonable options, including a no-fault system, including the professional liability fund that the trial bar has suggested as a model physicians ought to consider, even though we're somewhat cynical about that view, since typically lawyers do not have non-economic damage pain and suffering awards in the legal malpractice cases that they have. And there are other considerations that are quite different for medical malpractice than legal malpractice. But it's a legitimate issue that should be discussed, vetted, and considered in the interim on an objective basis. So we would encourage the committee to adopt the A7 amendments. We believe it goes to the heart of the proposal as the work group and proponents have worked on it. I understand that there will be an additional technical amendment, the dash A8, and that the department and the proponents of that amendment have come to some agreement on language for that amendment, and we would support that as well. Anyway, we appreciate the committee's time and opportunity to discuss this issue and actually begin the process for a broader-based, more substantive, long-term response to the medical malpractice crisis that we face today. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Gallant? Senator Walker.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gallant, I know that you're in this building a lot, so you know there's been a lot of questions raised about SAFE, and a lot of disturbing questions, actually. So as a legislator asking to expand SAFE's authority into a program that's going to assist your physicians, I think it's a good thing what we're trying to do, but I'm also a bit nervous because of the activities that SAFE has been involved in and not been accountable. So I'm not quite sure why you believe it's not appropriate to be discussing legislative oversight of SAFE as we expand their authority to implement this program. I don't really think that requires a priority bill, if anyone has any left. We've all used them up trying to get business and labor bills out of committee. But be that as it may, this is the appropriate bill, I think, to be talking about that, because we are expanding their authority.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I appreciate your view. Obviously, the legislature has decided that another bill, which has already gone through part of the process, is one vehicle to discuss that issue. Essentially, what the committee is being asked to do is to use 3630 as a secondary safety valve vehicle that may have maybe greater legs, so to speak, in working its way through the process as a backup in case a conference committee does not retain the language in that legislation. I never suggested that discussing the SAFE issue or oversight is not an appropriate topic for this body or the legislature generally, but there are other ways of doing that other than adding that issue to this bill to discuss that policy issue. It was discussed on the House side as a possible amendment to this legislation. Obviously, it's legitimate for you to have that same view here. We simply disagree that this is the right mechanism for that issue, which is controversial. I mean, I have been around this building for a long time. There has been a controversy between the proponents and opponents on the SAFE issue for well over a decade, close to two decades, it's just not new news, at least to me. It may be to others.
All right, thank you for those candid remarks. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Or none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Lane. You're going to speak in favor of something. This is good. This is a nice change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do come before you to speak in favor of 3630. It is the product of an awful lot of people's time and effort, considering the issues facing providers in rural Oregon. During testimony on the House side, we heard of a number of reasons driving the rates of insurance. And yet, when you look at states where they have sort of tort restrictions, the rates are still escalating without check. So we come to the table with the position that there's something else going on in the system. There's something that needs to address, and the way to best address that is to gather information that is an objective-based information and find out whether we can come up with a long-term solution. On the House side, we also came to the table with a proposal for a PLF type of model for all physicians inside the state. And as you just heard from my colleague, Mr. Gallant, he's cynical about such a proposal. And yet the actuarial testimony on the House side was that for $5,000 a year, that would be the total amount of coverage necessary for all physicians, given the number of physicians and given the rates that they're exposed to. So we think that is a viable proposal, or certainly one that needs some investigation and consideration. And that's where we came to the table with or our participation in House Bill 3630. Sections 10 and 11 of the bill would establish a professional panel to review the reason why we see these cyclical trends in insurance. We have a crisis every 10 years, and it just so happens it coincides usually when the market is down. There's got to be other things driving the rates of insurance, and we should get to the bottom of that and fix it once and for all. So Section 11 of the bill indicates that the panel is going to gather, analyze, and evaluate data on the availability, costs, and transactions of medical professional liability insurance, considering Oregon market trends on premium losses, and other factors affecting the competitiveness of the Oregon market and regulatory options for minimizing cyclical trends. Now, during the work groups, there were many items that could have been included in that description. It could have run a laundry list of 2 pages of things that this panel was going to be charged with. I think that that is sufficiently broad to cover things like insurance rating practices, insurance investment practices, the issue of tort reform, as you've all been hearing about this session, is certainly one of those options. But let's look at states where they have so-called tort reform and limitations on access to justice, and let's check their insurance rates. If there's no decrease in the amount of insurance to the physicians in those states, why would Oregon embark on a course to try what is proven to be an otherwise failed proposal? So we are optimistic that 3630 is not only a short-term relief now for rural health providers. And you've heard this morning, the reasons why there may be a lack of rural health care providers is multifactorial. There's not enough patients. The socioeconomic situations in some of the Oregon rural climates is not conducive to attracting physician talent. There's lots of reasons besides the insurance rates. 3630 is a short-term relief. The panel and the recommendations may provide the roadmap for a long-term solution for all Oregonians. The other comment that I would make is based on Mr. Gallant's comment about the $11 million or whatnot. That was one of the things discussed during the work group sessions, and the fact that one provider or one insured might exhaust all of the amount of monies that's been set aside for this program. And I would refer you to page 2, line 36. And the bill states, the premium reduction shall be a percentage of the actual premium charge for medical professional liability insurance in the market of authorized insurers for limits purchased up to $1 million per occurrence and $3 million aggregate. there's not going to be a situation where there's a premium reduction to any individual physician in amounts greater than actually stated in that section. So we're going to have control over who can access the system and making sure that it's spread across the board as best can be done with the amount of money available. We have anecdotal evidence of physicians leaving. I submit that 2 years from now, when this report is made to this committee or another committee, we'll have better information available and more objective information for you to consider long-term solutions. I think short-term, there's no reason to tinker with a system that works well for all Oregonians now without getting to the bottom of why we have this problem, why it's a recurring problem, and what we can do to fix the problem long-term. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lane. And for those people that are waiting for House Bills 2094 and 2368, the Judiciary Committee will come back at 3 p.m. to take up those issues. We're going to try to do 6:55 before we finish today, and then we'll come back at 3. All right, so we have one last person signed up, Paul Cosgrove. And then I'll allow anyone else who wants to testify, come one, come all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Reinsurance Association of America. And as that name implies, that may describe our interest in 3630, a bill that deals with an aspect of our business, the reinsurance of medical malpractice insurance. We are the proponents of the A8, and as you heard in previous testimony from Mr. Gallant and Corey Streisinger, there has been an agreement on some additional clarification language that's based on the A8, which is being passed out to you as a hand-engrossed version of the A8 amendments that reflects that agreement that we have reached this morning amongst all the interested parties. And I will briefly describe its purpose and effect and then be happy to answer any questions. One of the options that SAFE may bring forward to the Office of Rural Health Policy and the Department as part of its plan for addressing this would have SAFE act as a reinsurer, actually reinsuring all or a portion of the risk of the primary medical malpractice insurers. We were concerned that if that option were identified, that to the maximum extent feasible and practical, that risk be transferred back into the commercial market for two reasons. One, the commercial market, if there's a loss that exceeds the $10 million amount, that's the commercial market's problem. It's not anything that would affect the workers' compensation funds. And secondly, to try to maximize use of the commercial market in lieu of a separate new market, which we think is both appropriate and probably efficient. The language of the A8s as hand engrossed provides that SAFE Corporation must make all reasonable efforts consistent with the goals of this 2003 Act to transfer any assumed reinsurance liability. As you've also heard, there may be lots of other options in this plan that have nothing to do with assumed risk. There may be financial reinsurance, which is financial participation without transfer of risk, and this A8 amendment doesn't address that issue. That's still permitted. It just addresses the narrow issue that if SAFE, as part of its plan, proposes to reinsure and assume risk, that to the maximum extent practical, it use its reasonable efforts to transfer that back to the commercial market to protect the fund and to maximize use of the commercial market. I would be happy to answer any questions. My clients also reviewed the A7s and believes those are helpful clarifications, so we would support both the A7s and the A8s as handed for us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cosgrove?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Cosgrove, do you have a position on the A9s?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we do not. My client hasn't even seen the A9s, so I don't have a position on that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Corey, do you want to come up and answer any questions or give us any closing remarks or just chat with us in general?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, Corey Streisinger from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I don't believe I have anything to add. We appreciate the committee's time, and I'll certainly be happy to answer any additional questions that have come up either from the previous testimony or other issues.
All right. sitting here wondering this question, and I'm not sure why I'm wondering it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why is SAFE's participation necessary in this process that's being set up?
Mr. Chair, we view this as an insurance program, and SAFE is the insurance company which is owned by the state and which the state and the legislature has the power to direct. In addition, SAFE has the ability to administer the program, evaluate the reinsurance options, and assist in selecting ones that can best carry out the purposes of the Act.
All right, and I would assume then that the insurance division, this is beyond the scope of the insurance divisions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The insurance division oversees the insurance market but does not participate directly in it.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, Senator Warren?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dressinger, you had a great comment that I just wrote down. That in answer to the chair's question, it's the insurance company owned by the state with the power to direct. I like that. Problem is, I don't think that we do have much power to direct SAFE. So could you respond to the A9 amendments and what your position would be on those?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we would ask that you not include the A9 amendments in this bill. We think the issue of oversight of SAFE is a very legitimate legislative discussion. We think there are very strong feelings about what the appropriate response to that issue is. We would prefer that this bill not become a vehicle for that debate with the potential risk to this bill. In addition, the specific solution proposed by the A9 amendments is not the only legitimate solution for discussion. We would certainly, and I believe the governor would be happy to engage in a discussion of what options there might be, but the A9 amendments don't represent the only options and may not be the preferable option from his perspective.
Well, Ms. Dressinger, the problem is that, as Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out, SAFE is a state agency when it wants to be, and it isn't when it doesn't want to be, and it's sort of in this never-never land that we don't have access to. So I'm just trying to – I just think if we're expanding their authority, we need to have a little bit more careful consideration about what they're doing. What would be your position about adding the disclosure requirement that we added to 3630 into this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, on the merits of that issue, I don't have a position on the issue of whether it's appropriate in this bill. I guess I would just say a couple of things. One of them is I actually don't know whether it's sufficiently connected to the relating clause, which is relating to physicians. Secondly, I would have the same concern about having this bill become a vehicle for a debate that doesn't necessarily relate to the subject and perhaps getting bogged down by that. And thirdly, just in all honesty, if the bill in which this committee did insert those provisions got a non-concurrence over on the House side, I'm not sure that there's any reason the same thing wouldn't happen to this bill. On the merits, I don't have a position to articulate.
Okay.
I do understand, however, that that particular provision captures the outcome of a recent Court of Appeals decision and therefore represents the current state of the law.
Right. Well, I'm getting the sense, Ms. Dressinger, there's a lot of people who are nervous about this bill and adding anything to it, thinking it might explode and not get where it needs to be. But I submit to you that people have a lot of nervous thoughts at this time of year, and it's very, you have to be very careful about bills and relating clauses. So I don't know. I appreciate your comments, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator.
I've got a question. I'd like some clarification on the A7 amendments in the Section 15, Subsection 2, where it says that the State Acts Insurance Fund Corporation shall provide all data and other information required by the director to prepare the reports required under this section. The question is, to whom do they provide that information?
Mr. Chair, they would provide it to the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
I see. Okay. To DCBS. And access to that data and information by the Legislative Assembly would be...
Well, Mr. Chair, unless it is confidential under some other provision of law, we would anticipate that it would be available to the Legislative Assembly and members of the public. And I believe that in light of that recent Court of Appeals ruling, at least the current state of the law is that very little is confidential.
Now, help me understand this, too, in terms of legal function. There was a unanimous decision by the Court of Appeals with respect to the SAFE public records issue. So I'm assuming that that court's ruling now governs the agency. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, I have to say I do not know what the exact status, whether there is a stay or anything else with respect to that case. I honestly haven't been tracking that procedural issue that closely.
Let's bring Mr. DiLorenzo up, because I'm kind of curious how that interplay is, the unanimous decision by the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, John DiLorenzo. The State of Oregon Attorney General representing SAFE requested and succeeded in obtaining, after the Circuit Court decision, a stay of execution of the judgment pending appeal. Pursuant to the stay order, SAFE was to produce certain documents and was then to prepare what is called a privilege log, indicating lists of those documents which SAFE refused to produce pending eventual appeal. That stay is still in place. The State of Oregon has, through the Attorney General's office, has notified me that it intends to seek review in the Supreme Court. They are continuing to refuse to provide documents, but are supplying me privilege logs. I have received so far approximately 30 pages of logs noting voluminous documents which SAFE refuses to supply pending appeal. There are two more privilege logs expected from the Attorney General's office. So I would say there are, as of yet, thousands and thousands and thousands of documents which SAFE is refusing to supply, notwithstanding the Court of Appeals decision.
Right, and that assumes by operation of the stay.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Just to follow up, directed at Ms. Geisinger, I very much favor the bill, and I appreciate your work in helping put it together. I guess I'm a little bit distressed at all the kind of ambiguous statements that, gee, we don't want, it's the amendment that Senator Walker's talking about is a good idea, but not this isn't the right vehicle. You know, and I thought before, well, I wouldn't want to insert that if it's a poison pill, but I kind of changed my mind, and I think I'm willing to risk it. And the reason is because I just sense such stonewalling. You know, not from you, but from those who apparently are defenders of SAFE and who are so willing to go to such lengths as to defeat an important bill like this. They think their confidentiality is so important. And that makes me think it's that much more important to breach their confidentiality, to see what they're hiding. And I guess I would just caution you that, I mean, you can say, you know, the -9 amendments are not the only way to get at this, and there may be other suggestions, you know, or there may be other vehicles. But I think this is the right vehicle, and I guess I would just encourage your office to work very closely with Senator Walker and members of this committee in crafting amendments that you would prefer to help accomplish the SAFE disclosure, because I think it is very important.
Further discussion? Anyone else out there wishing to jump into the fray? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate the testimony. We closed the public hearing on House Bill 3630. We'll move into a work session on Senate Bill 655. And with respect to 3630, it's on the agenda again for tomorrow. So everybody will be on standby, I guess. See what we do. Senator Walker, 655, when you're ready.
Yes, Mr. Chair, let me just skip these papers out. Okay, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 655 is a gotten stuff of my Senate Bill 828 that we passed off the Senate floor some time ago. It is yet another one of those bills that got sent to the House Business and Labor Committee, and the committee closed, and the bill is sitting there. This bill would provide phone access to domestic violence victims of stalking, and elder abuse. It passed this assembly, this chamber, on a huge margin, and the Department of Corrections likes this bill. There are a lot of folks who think this is a good bill because currently a telecommunications provider can refuse telephone service if you owe an outstanding bill. This bill requires them to enter into a reasonable payment plan with someone who needs telephone service but has an outstanding bill. And if that person does not maintain the service, they will have it disconnected. So there's really no risk to the telecommunications provider, but I think this is it's been a problem in my county. I serve on the Lane County Domestic Violence Council, and they asked me to bring this bill forward, and that's why I've done so. And it patterns a program that the PUC currently does with people who get medical exceptions for needing telephones. So unless my committee has any other questions, I believe everyone on this panel voted for the bill, Senate Bill 828.
All right. This is a work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burry.
I would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 655 and thank Senator Walker for bringing these forward.
All right. Senator Burry moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 655. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion passes.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 655 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick, I move Senate Bill 655 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion or any discussion on the motion?
Just, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for hearing this bill as a co-sponsor of Senate Bill 828. I know that that was important to you, and it's important to everyone else who supports this. And David Neagle's here if we needed any further discussion, but I think everyone is fine, and I appreciate this opportunity to try this yet again.
All right,
Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I might just remind both of you and Senator Walker, and maybe even myself, that under our procedure, you can add your name as a sponsor when the bill comes to the
floor. Great. We're going to check and make sure it didn't have a subsequent referral. I don't think it did because we cast it across the floor. We'll just verify. So we'll be in a short.
Oh, but 828 had a subsequent referral?
No, we want to make sure 655.
Oh, did not.
Because
okay.
That vehicle may, we may also need to include a motion
right.
To rescind. Well, actually, 655 is the starter. It's going to be the subject of an interim discussion.
That's true.
Because they kept amending it in Washington.
And isn't Senator Starr's name on 655?
I think it is.
You want to keep your name on
here?
Senator Starr?
You bet.
Yes, it is.
Anybody want to give a speech?
You know, Mr. Chair, I thought this was fascinating that when we're talking about disclosure and public records of safe, how big my file has suddenly become. And I didn't ask for much.
It does not have. All right. Then the motion was to move the bill to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. There's no subsequent to Ways and Means. Further discussion? Any objections to the motion? If not, the motion passes. And I assume that Senator Walker would like to carry
the
bill, as long as you refrain from any pithy comments about the other House. As appointed committees.
I promise no pithy comments. I'm just going to say it's the gut and stuff.
All right, great. And with that, we're going to be in recess until 3 p.m.
We have House Bill 2368B in gross version, and I believe last week we heard from Mr. McCauley on this bill, and I want to go through it again because Pete Shepard stays up nights doing things like section-by-section analyses, and I wanted to go through this because I think it is helpful. So Pete prepared a section-by-section look at 2368, and then also an amendment look at it, and again he has a suggested order of consideration. So you should have both those documents. And so with that, we'll go through this real quickly. Section 1 of this 2368 deals with some definitions.
Where is that?
Do you have...
Well, I'm looking. Can I find my section first?
Yes.
Well, man, this bill is something else. The two of them. I have 2094. Come on, I know it's here. Section, is it that thing or is it the chart?
Looks like this.
Yeah, it's the chart. Okay. All right. Oh, there's one. That's not being gross. All right. Well, I'm having trouble locating it, but go ahead.
Okay. This first section deals with definitions. And, again, this is going to be definitions to enhance enforcement. It has a new definition of contraband cigarettes, definition of taxpayer, which is means certain distributors who are required to pay the tobacco taxes. A definition of transporter that is amended so that a common carrier, meaning a truck that's carrying tobacco products throughout here, I think is the idea, would not be, is not a distributor, because the distributor, they're going to be the ones that are we're looking at these tax portions. Section 2, again, amends the definition of distribution. And here, the idea is that distribution will include the possession in the state of untaxed cigarettes that were transported to the state in quantities of more than 199, unless the person in possession of the untaxed cigarette is in possession of those in order to transport them to a location outside the state. So distribution will include anyone who's possessing those for sale in that amount in for sale in Oregon. Section 3 is the portion that we heard about different, you may recall, statistics on what revenue we're losing because we don't have a good way to count how many cigarettes are taxed, or excuse me, sold. This would require prepayment of the taxes on cigarettes by purchasing those cigarette tax stamps that were talked about. Section 4 makes it clear that if that prepaid tax is paid, and then they need not pay the distribution taxes that are mentioned elsewhere in the state, or excuse me, in the statutes, so that it's clear that there's not a double taxation, because we are shifting kind of the way the taxes will be paid. Section 5 is a funding change for the task force. And I believe we heard some testimony on this last time. The joint task force that is DOJ, Department of Revenue, and Oregon State Police. The taxes imposed under this section shall be held in suspense account. An amount necessary to pay the expenses incurred will be appropriated to the Department of Revenue for the task force. The other fives are basically technical amendments, sections 5. Sections 6 through 9 are basically technical. Section 10, person who distributes less than 200 or does not require prepayment of taxes by a person who distributes cigarettes for personal use or consumption rather than sale. And this is for not more than 199 cigarettes. So they would not be required to do the prepaid taxes. Section 11 is technical. Section 12 confirms that the cigarette taxes are to be paid by the retail consumer but collected for convenience through the prepayment. So ultimately, we understand that the consumer will be paying these taxes, but to make sure that we do capture the revenue, they will be paid by the distributor. Section 12 is technical. Section 13 requires a distributor's license for anyone who sells cigarettes as a distributor, including sales of points outside of the state. Section 14 deals with a wholesaler, clarifies that a wholesaler is subject to all the penalties applicable to a distributor who violates taxation laws. So that would be captured and may clarify that enforcement would be applicable to them. Then Section 15 deals with the licensing of a distributor. The old language you can see on line 19 of page 7, the department, well, it used to be say, the department shall issue a distributor's license. That will be changed to may issue a distributor's license, and they can decide not to issue one if they determine that there's reason to believe they will not comply with tax laws. And then that would then be appealable to the magistrate division of the tax court. Section 16 would allow disclosure of licensing for distributors and wholesalers. I don't know if I'm going into too much detail.
Well, keep on going. I'll make sure at least we've got a preliminary overview of the sections.
Okay. Section 17 deals with allow the cancellation or revocation of a distributor's license for violation of the federal as well as state tax laws, again with review by the tax court. Section 18 it requires the Department of Revenue to furnish these stamps that we're going to be requiring distributors to place upon their cigarettes for the prepayment. 19, the distributors to keep records for 5 years rather than 4 years of their transactions. That's in Section 19. And again, that's records related to cigarette transactions, transportation, or storage.
Mr. Chair, Council, do you know why there was a need to change that from 4 years to five?
I do not, and I do see, though, that it clarifies what records will be kept. I don't know what the need is for the 5 years.
Okay. Pete, do you have an answer to that? Why five, or...? Is it just a
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and I've asked Mr. McCulley to come up to the table with me as well. He's the Assistant Attorney General assigned to our Tobacco Compliance Task Force.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to your question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I believe it was you that asked the question, right?
No.
No? Senator Walker. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I should pay more attention there. The expansion on the time for keeping the records was for a couple reasons. It was a suggestion by the Department of Revenue. They wanted a longer record-keeping period, both for their audits, when they go out and do an audit function. When we go back and when Revenue goes in and does an assessment, they're able to go back a number of years, and 5 years seem to them to be a better period of time in which to do that. Four was a little odd. Five is the record requirement for almost all other revenue record-keeping requirements in other areas, I believe, and they wanted to make it consistent.
Well, I find it funny because I thought for tax purposes it's 3 years for your records. So I'm not sure where the 5 years comes in.
Now we need a tax return here.
Well,
yeah.
You know, now that I think we drafted this originally quite a while ago, but now as I'm thinking about it, I think that suggestion, I'm thinking on the fly here, I think that the five-year recommendation was because RICO prosecutions are 5 years on the statute of limitations.
Okay, that one I'll buy. The three-year,
And so, yeah, we wanted to make sure that there was a sufficient amount of evidence based on a five-year statute of limitations on a RICO prosecution.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion?
Bring in there something.
All right.
Okay. Section 20 looks like a technical section. Section 21 provides for forfeiture of the cigarettes that do not have the prepayment tax stamps. Section 22, seized cigarettes are to be destroyed and not. I think what this would do is would be cut the ability for redemption back of the cigarettes by the person from whom they were seized. You could still redeem back the vending machines or receptacles or other items that were taken or seized. Section 23 and 24 are technical. Section 25 deals with Department of Revenue in relation to refunding the taxes for Indian reservations. My understanding is that's a requirement that, and I'm sure that Mr. McCauley could deal with that, but these taxes would be, there would be a refund for the prepaid tax for those that were sold on tribal grant lands. Section 25A, again, appeals on these issues will go to the tax court unless otherwise provided. Section 26 clarifies that the venue in these cases will be Marion County Circuit Court for violation of the tax laws. Section 27 gives the AG the ability or the statutory ability to investigate violations of the tax cigarette tax laws. 27A allows for payment of DOJ and OSP and foreign revenue from the expense account, a continuous appropriation. Again, this deals with the funding issues that Mr. Shepherd spoke to when we heard about this last week. Section 20.
Yes, Senator.
Let's back up a little bit. 26, Marion County is the venue. What's the rationale for that?
I think because Department of Revenue. That's my guess. Pete?
They don't want to go to Harney County to litigate.
Mr. Chair.
Government lawyers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it wasn't any aversion to Harney County. I've been in court in Harney County, and it's a lovely place. I think the rationale simply is that the tax is due and payable at the Department of Revenue here in Salem.
Would be, I mean, wouldn't it, if you're bringing the action, the government would be choosing which court to bring the action anyway. I mean, couldn't you just choose Marion County?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think it removes any question about whether Marion County is the proper venue for the action. I don't know if the issue has actually come up, but perhaps Mr. McCauley.
The current statute already says that in any action, venue lies partly in Marion County. We wanted to clarify to make sure that there was venue in Marion County because this is where the Department of Revenue lies, and so there would always be venue on any tax related offense.
And you're telling me there was some ambiguity about that?
It was not as clear as it could have been.
Mr. Chair, just call.
Sure.
Does this apply to the private right of action we're creating? We may create. Does it impact that venue?
Would you like to respond? Let me go ahead if you have an answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that as far as I understand, private right of action that is mainly at issue in these two bills has to do with the NPM complementary legislation in House Bill 2094.
Mr. Chairman, considering, I think that's right. When we go through the bills, we can look at which ones would be focused on enforcing these tax laws that would be at issue, but I think most of the amendments that we have are to deal with, as I said, the more the internet sales and the NPM, or excuse me, the you know, the later sections when we get to those, section 72 to on, so we can look at those.
Senator Ringo, I do not believe that there is a private right of action statutorily either created or currently existing in ORS 323 or in House Bill 2368.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that in the delivery sales portion of 2368, there is in section 82 a private cause of action. And as to that private cause of action, section 82 is silent as to the venue for that claim. And I'm just looking here to see Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe that the venue provision of section 26 of the bill would apply to that claim.
Okay, thank you.
To continue, section 28 deals with civil penalties for enforcement by Department of Revenue for violation of these tax laws would make them not to exceed $1,000 per violation, and those would be appealable to the tax court. Section 29, again, is a section that any contraband cigarettes, and that, again, contraband cigarettes was the definition in section 1, are to be forfeited and destroyed. And again, there can be an appeal to the tax court on that section. Section 30, I think, was the section that we really, Mr. McCauley went through in some detail when we first heard this. This would be the new criminal penalties for unlawful distribution of cigarettes, moving it to a graduated scale. It used to be just a Class A misdemeanor, and as you can see in Section 30 on page 13, it would now be, you'd be looking at a 90-day period, and you'd go by how many total cigarettes were involved, and that would then, you know, with the increasing number of cigarettes, would take it from an A misdemeanor all the way up to a B felony if there were more than 120,000 sold. So that's the first section that deals with the cigarette taxes. The next section...
I want to interject for just a second. I want to go back to the private right of action issue, because it says that bring an action enforce provisions of Section 73 to 82 of the Act. If you go to Section 75, similarly, someone violates this section, they would be subject to civil or this private right of action. And subsection 6 says all other laws of the state, and it shall comply with all other laws of the state applicable to sales of tobacco that occur entirely within Oregon, including but not limited to, and then it cites 323-500 to 323-640. So, which are the same statutes, where it says any violation of any provision of 323-500 to 2640 or any rule adopted there under shall be deemed, blah, 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 and that's worth of anything. So I want to make sure as we look at this, we're not, you know, inadvertently tying it together somehow. All right.
And Mr. Chairman, to that point, I would also point out that that Section 75 is the person accepting the order for delivery sale. And so it would be interesting, too, to see which entities would be interested in suing them for their receipt. I don't know. I mean, it won't. We'll have to be interesting to see. So the next section, I'll go through this more quickly, because those were the next are the tobacco products law taxes, and this would have the basically the other than cigarettes. I don't know if that's the best way to look at it, but this deals with the same kind of enforcement provisions for the other tobacco products. Section 33 makes it clear that taxes on tobacco products are to be paid quarterly with returns filed. Tax returns may be filed later, you know, later with an extension from the Department of Revenue. Section 34 requires all persons selling tobacco products in the state to have a license. Includes persons who sell to points outside of the state. So there's a licensing changes the definitions there for who it needs to be have a distributor's license. Section 35, department may require a security deposit to ensure compliance with the tobacco products tax laws. Then has an appeal right for the suspension of the license. Also, in Section 36, information on distributors is not confidential, so it can be disclosed for the tobacco products distributors. Section 37 allows for the cancellation of a license of a distributor of tobacco products with appeal again to the tax court. Section 38, distributor sells less than 100 cigars or less than $50 wholesale worth of tobacco products that are already prepaid. An invoice is not required. Section 39, contents of the invoice for wholesale tax products to be retained for 5 years. Again, it has that 5-year record keeping. If person is not in possession of the invoice, presumption is that there was no tax paid on the tobacco product, and the tax and penalty are immediately due, with the penalty being up to $1,000. Sections 40 through 45 are technical. Section 46, appeal by a person from the Department of Revenue's action under the tobacco product statute is to tax court, making that clear. Again, 47 to 52, I think, are technical, and that would take us to Section 53. Again, this goes to the funding sources for the task force that will be enforcing these. Section 55, again, mirrors the Marion County issue that we saw earlier with venue lying in Marion County. 56 is the penalties section that, again, would mirror the section that has the graduated scale, or graduated based upon the number of cigarettes. This is the new penalties and criminal penalties under this, you know, for the tobacco products. 57, again, allowing seizure and destruction of tobacco products that are not in compliance by Department of Revenue. 58, crime of unlawful distribution of tobacco products. This has the, again, the graduated system. 56 was a person required to obtain a license to sell if they're selling without a license. 58 would be just unlawful distribution of tax products in general, meaning you're not paying the taxes even if you are licensed. Section 59 allows the AG's office to bring action to recover the amounts of any taxes, penalties, and interest due, and allows them to investigate any criminal action, criminal violation of tobacco product laws. I think 60 to 66 are technical in nature. And that would then, and then we have the applicability dates, which I believe we had some discussion on. I think the thing to highlight here is that the distribution, changes to the distribution of cigarettes or tobacco products and reporting of it would start January 1, 2004 to give time to for the distributors to be able to comply. The next sections are the portions that are repealed because they're superseded with these new enforcement sections. I think if you have any questions about those, please refer them to Mr. McCauley or Mr. Shepard, because I didn't look at those in great detail. And that brings us to tobacco delivery sales, and this is kind of what some of the focus has been on 72 to 73, we talk about the definitions for tobacco delivery sales. Again, this is where you're delivering the tobacco, and this would be for mailing, and I think that the testimony we heard is this would often be by an internet type sale. 74 prohibits delivery to a person under legal age, so we avoid selling tobacco to minors. 75, a person delivering tobacco to a consumer must verify the age of the recipient, be licensed, and must make disclosures about sales to underage persons prohibited from receiving and taxation, and must comply with the reporting requirements. Section 76, to deliver tobacco by mail or shipment, a person must obtain a written statement from the consumer who's receiving them, certifying that the consumer is of legal age to receive the tobacco, and must confirm that recipient understands the illegality of receipt, and must make a good faith effort to verify that the consumer is of age.
Senator Ringo, then Senator.
Is that written statement? Can that be defined in a way that includes through the internet or through email, or does it have to be on a physical piece of paper?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I believe if you look at page 30, line 41, there's a notice that would be sent out electronically. That would have to meet the requirements. That would be electronic. My understanding, though, is that the certification is actually on paper. So, unless I'm wrong on that.
Senator Ringo, this amendment that will actually help the situation. Yes.
Okay.
And also, I had a question. It says the recipient understands the illegality of receipt if under minimum age. What happens? What are the penalties? Probably if someone lies, they have fake ID, they lie that they're 18 and they're not 18, and they get the cigarettes and they get caught. What's the penalty?
Pete, I'm going to let Pete handle that one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Burdick, this is from memory from last session, which is the last time I've had occasion to look at these statutes, but I believe that there is a minor infraction, the elements of which are, in effect, minor in possession of tobacco. And if my recollection is correct, it carries a small fine, $50 or $100, something like that. So there actually is a violation that a minor who possesses tobacco products commits.
But this bill isn't creating
this, this doesn't change those consequences one way or the other.
Yeah, I understood that. I just didn't know what it was. And then the other, on the converse, what is the fine for the person who delivers tobacco to somebody who's underage? And is there any... is it an affirmative defense that they thought the person was legal, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the remedies for violation of any aspect of the delivery sales amendments are in Section 81 of the bill on line 32 and over on to line 30, page 30, I'm sorry, on page 32 and into page 33. The sanctions that attach there attach in addition to any other provisions of law. It's our view that a merchant who delivers tobacco products to an underage person commits an unlawful trade practice, an act in violation of the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and there are also other sanctions provided by law for delivery of tobacco products to minors. So the
sanctions that are described in Section 81 of the Engrossed House Bill 2368 on pages 32 to 33 are in addition to the sanctions otherwise provided in current law.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, it looks to me like some of these sanctions are for the people who sell the cigarettes, and some are applied to the people who buy the cigarettes, although it says buying under the name of another person. So would that be the fake ID situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that is well, on page 33, lines 3 through 5,
I guess my question is how are you going to extract the $10,000 fine out of a 13-year-old?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Brick, I'm not sure that the 13-year-old commits any violation of the delivery sales amendments. And the sanction that you're discussing here applies only to violations of these amendments. So I don't think you're prescribing new penalties here for the minor, even if the minor uses false identification. That's how I read these anyway.
Okay, well, maybe I just need to look at them a little more closely. When it said under the name of another person, I thought the scenario I immediately thought of is a 13-year-old using their 18-year-old sister's driver's license to obtain the cigarettes. Is that wrong?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that the prohibitions here that are provided in the delivery sales provisions attached to the provider of the product, not to the purchaser.
So when they say provide knowingly submit a false certification, that's okay. Well, thank you. It's a little confusing.
All right.
It's just me. Maybe it's just because it's 3:30.
It's 3:30. We're not used to doing this.
I'm not used to thinking at 3:30.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, in Section 76, a person selling tobacco in this manner must obtain a certification from the prospective consumer that includes a written statement. So that would be you have to obtain a certification from the 13-year-old consumer, you know, or we want to avoid that. And then I think the issue that's confusing is who they would then submit that to if it's under the name of another person, with they meaning the seller. So we'll have to look. I'll get an answer to that and see who they submit that to.
Because the way it's phrased now, it looks like the person who knowingly submits a false certification, the person who submits is the person who's buying, because the buyer just has to obtain a certification.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll find the portion that says that what they need to do with a certification. I'm sure at some point they're supposed to have Department of Revenue check up on them and make sure they're doing it correctly. So I'll find that portion and bring it to your attention. To wrap up, so...
Wait. Yeah, I had a question about tax liability. Don't go away, Pete. It says in your little cheat sheet in Section 76, there's supposed to be notice regarding tax liability, but I don't see that in the bill in Section 76 at all, and I was curious, did I miss it?
76.73, it says. Sends a notice to official. Sends a notice to the prospective customer. It's not the same kind of notice I think you're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, how do you collect a tax, and who's responsible for collecting it or paying it? And I don't see anything here about that notice. So if you buy cigarettes over the Internet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, let me describe to you how I got to that summary of Section 76. Section 76 on lines 41 through 42 on page 30 says that the notice must meet the requirements of Section 77.
Oh, so I've got to go to 77.
So then you go to 77. And when you trace that rabbit down that hole, you come to...
Four.
Subsection 4, exactly, mm-hmm. of Section 77, and that's where the reference to the how the applicable tax had been paid or is to be paid. And again, the concept here of all of these taxes is that, in theory, they're ultimately owed by the consumer of the product, but for convenience, we collect them from the distributors of these products. And so...
So the distributor is supposed to add on the price of the tax of cigarettes when it sells them over the Internet, and then the distributor is responsible for paying them to the state of Oregon. But if the distributor does not, then they can be charged with a crime. So it's not the consumer who's liable for paying these taxes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the consumer doesn't have the sanctions. The sanctions don't attach to the consumer in the same way they attach to the distributor. As a technical legal matter, they are taxes owed by the consumer on the transaction, but the state collects them for convenience, as the bill provides, from the distributors. And this bill, the delivery sales amendments in that context, fit into this bill because those folks who cause those deliveries to be made are defined to be distributors and therefore responsible for the collection of the tax.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Senator Ringo.
As long as you're okay, if I could ask another question, please. You know, this Section 76 references the age of the purchaser, and you know, perhaps that's a concern, but in this document you gave me about the Attorney General's report relating to kids and tobacco, it has several recommendations on how to restrict that, and nowhere does it mention Internet sales. And I guess, am I right in believing that it's not a problem of children receiving cigarettes over the Internet? That's really not how they get them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, actually, I think that has developed into a problem. At the time that we prepared that report, which was based upon a series of hearings around the state conducted 3 years ago now, we had just begun to become aware of cases in which tobacco products were delivered to minors as a result of Internet activity. And so it was not addressed explicitly in the report simply because we didn't recognize it as having the magnitude it does now. And in fact, we have done undercover sting operations on Internet sellers of tobacco products and found it disturbingly easy to purchase and take delivery of product.
But does that mean that kids do it? Are there 15-year-olds buying cigarettes through the Internet?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the particular cases that we did involved... a product called BIDIS, BIDIS, which were tobacco-like products. And we actually had case complaints from people who said that children had made purchases. And indeed, we had undercover kids who made purchases for us. So it is a problem.
Thank you.
Okay, to wrap up... I think we've looked at 75 and 76. This is, again, the certification that you have to receive from the consumer prior to delivery. Section 76 is basically the licensing for this type of delivery tobacco. Person must be licensed. 77 deals with the notice requirements that have to be on the tobacco. Distributed or mailed, and that is includes that sale to an unregistered person is illegal. We heard, and there is an amendment that will deal with lines 16 through 18 there that basically this is the portion that says that you have to have it labeled that it's hazardous to smoke, and requirement to verify age, and in fact tobacco is subject to tax. Section 78, with a shipment of tobacco, notice must be sent that states that the Oregon tax must be paid and the person must be over 18. Requires that the receipt of the cigarettes be by a person of legal age who signs for receipt and makes a display of an ID. and that shows that the person receiving is the consumer that requested it or a resident of the consumer's home, and also that proof would be required that they are over, they're of age unless they appear to be over 27. Section 79, persons making such deliveries must file statements regarding delivery, including the consumer's name and address, the brands of tobacco that were sold in the quantity. Section 80, person filing delivery orders cannot ship without the proper tax stamps. 81 is the penalties that we were just discussing, and we can look at those in detail. And then Section 82 is kind of the portion that has gotten the most play, I think, from the amendments, which is who is to enforce these sections. So that's the bill, section by section. And before I lose your attention, not that I haven't already, we're gonna we will go quickly and excitedly through the amendments. And I hope you have all your amendments. If you've got them in numerical order, what I suggest is Mr. Shepherd has this kind of set up by suggested order of consideration. I think before we do that, we might want to go through them numerically just to see, to look at them real quickly. The B-15 amendment, I think from Bill Linden and the tobacco, and this is an amendment that deals with clarifying that a person who pays by check would also be covered in this situation rather than if they just paid by, most people pay by credit card on this kind of sale. So a person who pays by check would also be covered. That's the B-15. The B-16 amendment is from Mr. Gardner, and this is the amendment that we heard from the folks from the American Cancer Society. They originally opposed this one. This is the one that would take out the language in the bill dealing with the federal warning label on page 31, lines 16 through 18. I believe the Cancer Society is satisfied now that this would be redundant to have it stated in Oregon law, because federal law requires that warning to already be on the tobacco product.
Is there somebody from Cancer Society here?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, they touched base with me and said that the concerns that they raised orally last week, they've satisfied, and we're not raising those at this time.
All right, thank you.
Section 17, excuse me, I keep saying section, the B-17 amendment. Here's where we get into, first of all, is anyone, some of these have been, no one is championing but anymore, so I don't know if anyone is.
They're orphan amendments.
Yes.
Okay, this
is B-17 an orphan amendment, or is someone still interested? Orphan.
No.
No. Excuse me, Marshall. I'm sorry.
No.
The B-17. Then I'm sorry. I had misinterpreted your nod. So this amends Section 82. Again, this is the issue of who can enforce these provisions. The B-17 would make it clear that the AG can, and then any person that holds a permit, which is the permit for a tobacco product manufacturer. From the IRS to engage in business as a manufacturer or importer of tobacco products or as an export warehouse proprietor may bring an action to enforce the provisions of, and this is the general tax laws. That's what the B-17 amendment is. Marshall's here for that one.
That, Mr. Chair, Craig, that doesn't, that restricts major tobacco, big tobacco, from suing. Isn't that correct? So this just allows the AG to sue?
Well, let me do this. Let me just go through all of the amendments, then we'll go back through individually. We've got folks that want to talk on this on both sides.
Okay.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, the yes, Section 1 deals with the delivery sales aspect, and Section 2, which would be for any permit holder, would be for enforcement of the tax provisions generally.
Okay.
Section 18 is a task force that I think that Marshall Koba is here for this. This is a task force that was created. We heard some testimony on that, and there were some, I think, some people who wanted different people on that that I think we heard about already. B-19 amendments are conflict amendments. I don't know that anyone is opposed to those. B-20 is an amendment that, again, deals with Section 82. I think it's been referred to as a hybrid amendment. So, again, the AG would enforce the new sections on delivery sales in Section 1. Section 2 would also allow a person to enforce those delivery sales if they are a manufacturer with a permit. They are in compliance with, if you look on line 9, their compliance with the tax laws. That would include a master settlement, the MSPs, or a person who's in compliance with the escrow requirements who is not so I guess that would be the NPMs as well.
So whose are these?
Yeah.
Anybody out there claiming them?
Okay. Orphan?
Mark Nelson.
They also could enforce the delivery sales provisions against a tobacco manufacturer that is not a participating manufacturer of the MSA who is not in compliance.
Okay. Thank you.
21. Don't want to get lost here.
I had a 20.
We just talked about 20.
That was 20.
Mm-hmm.
20 is
anyone, have an extra
any proponent for 21? Marshall?
Yeah, that's
21. We had not received testimony. Let me look at it. Maybe you should speak to that one.
Okay, but this is Marshall's, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
Hold on.
22
okay.
is...
22 is a sunset on the funding portions for the task force.
This is the Cancer Society.
This is, I believe, the Cancer Society's. I don't know who all was concerned about. I know that the Department of Revenue was interested in that. The sunset provision.
On the task force. Yeah, I believe that was.
So that's the 22. The section, or the B-23, is the Cancer and Heart Society's run at the task force with a somewhat different membership, with more public membership on that.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That amendment is only something they want if there is a task force. If there's some
discussion.
All right. They're not advocating for a task force. They're just saying if there is one, they want.
All right.
The B-24 is from Senator Burdick, and this again deals with the issue that she highlighted in Section 76 of the bill, and this would change the requirements so that currently, when you deliver prior to delivering these cigarettes, you have to make a good faith effort to verify the information contained in the certification against a commercially available database or obtain a photocopy of a valid ID. And I believe this would make it more stringent so that if there was a fake ID or something, instead of making a good faith effort to verify the certification that the consumer is going to give you, that would be replaced with a language here that says you must verify that information contained in the certification against a commercially available database of government collected information showing the age or date of birth of the individual placing the order. And I don't have the 25s.
I have a 25.
Is that the same
amount? Well, I'm sharing the 25s with us.
I don't have 25s either.
Why do I have a 25? Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Well,
I think somebody asked me to draft it. But maybe I'm not supposed to admit it.
I'll save you, Senator. We'll move on to the B-26.
The
B-26 is here, and I believe this is from Senator Ringo.
Correct.
Is that correct?
John.
And this would it has at issue where the cigarettes can be located in a retail store, and the violation if they're not where they're supposed to be, where they are, and the issue would be where they are only accessible by store customer who has the assistance of a store employee.
All right. Great.
Behind lock and key in the vault.
All right, I'm going to go through my Captain Crunch decoding device here that Chief Shepard put together for me. Yeah, and I think just follow along here with me, if you will, but jump in if you think I've messed up somehow. Let's start with the 19. And what I'd like to do is try to get areas where there's clear consensus out of the way.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I got a little off track when we went from 19 to 20, and I was wondering if we could just recap that for
sure.
30 seconds.
All right. 19 and 20?
19 is conflict amendment.
19 is conflict.
Right.
20 is Frank Nelson's.
Correct.
All right. Now, my Captain Crunch coding device says that these conflict amendments DOJ supports. Anybody opposed out there in the audience to the 19s? You looked at them? Are they opposed to them? All right. Senator Burdick, would you do me a favor?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the B-19 amendments to House Bill 2263.
I want to move us into a work session. We probably were already by virtue of the posting, but...
And I would again move the B-19.
Right, Senator Burdick.
Wait a second. I have a note. I actually have a note, Senator Walker. It says that these have been superseded. The B-19s have been superseded.
Oops.
Did I make that note?
No, I wrote it on here.
You wrote it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of you.
Unfortunately, I didn't say superseded by
what? Probably the 25.
Do you have a date of your notes? Because I could go through my notes and see what I can find.
Okay. Is this a...
Are you on the right bill?
2368, right?
Oh, okay.
This says
proposed amendments to resolve conflicts to be engrossed House Bill 2368.
No.
Oh, here. The video testimony that I reviewed from 611, Pete Shepard was giving testimony along with Mr. McCauley, and he said the A-19s were superseded and in the bill now.
Oh, okay. I just screwed up there.
Peter.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm the guilty party in that. In this piece of confusion, I did say that they had been superseded. Subsequently, I tried to figure out how that could be, and I found indeed it is necessary. Short answer is it is necessary for the committee to do this conflict amendment. House Bill 2424 did pass and has been signed into law. It changes one word in the text of the provision in question, and so it is necessary to do the conflict amendment.
Okay.
It doesn't change anything in the meaning of the bill. It's just necessary to conform it to the previous change.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move the dash B-19 amendment to House Bill 2368.
All right. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the B-19 amendment to House Bill 2368. Discussion? Any objection?
No.
No objection. Motion passes. All right.
Oh, well, we're moving now. Okay. Adopted.
I was going to put hallelujah on it. Okay. Let's see what's next here. Number. Let's go to number 15 here. All right. Bill, did you want to speak to this? This looks pretty simple. You obviously support it. Brings checks into the mix.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden representing R.J. Reynolds. Very quickly, two technical tweaks to the bill. One provides that there would be an opportunity for someone to buy products over the Internet and purchase them by check. That does happen. Most people use credit or debit cards. if you are purchasing by check, what happens is you have to make the order, send the check has to be received, the check has to clear, and then the products are mailed. That just simply adds that option. And then the other change is to substitute the word provides for sends, because that takes into account the fact that the confirmations over the internet are provided to the purchaser, as opposed to send, which has more of a connotation of putting something in the mail. So when these were reviewed by legal counsel back east, they suggested that that would be a more encompassing word to use, and that's why we had the 15s drafted with that included.
Okay. Anybody out there oppose the 15s?
Lawyer would think up that last one.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the dash B-15 amendments to House Bill 2358.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the B-15 amendment to House Bill 2368. Discussion? Any objection? Objection? Motion passes. Let's now go to number 16.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Gardner's. I think we've talked about this already. On page 31, it would delete lines 16 through 18. This is the what would have required the notice to have this the federally required labeling and advertising act warnings, which I believe Mr. Gardner would say would be repetitive and of the federal.
All right. Anybody out there opposing B-16?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I don't like these amendments.
Oh, then I have a problem. You don't like them because you want duplicative language?
I'm not troubled by duplicative language.
Mr.
And
John?
Neither is the
Heart
Association.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I'm kind of ambivalent. There's lots of areas where we duplicate federal law and nobody seems to scream about it or care about it. And, you know, if they were to change federal law, well, we would have this law in place. So I'm just off of that. I don't think it's a big deal.
All right.
I don't think it's necessary to remove it. I'll put it that way.
Mr. Gardner, you want to speak to that? Senator Starr.
Oh.
Sir?
No, I made a note to myself as we were receiving testimony that this amendment's not needed.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Philip Morris. The language which we're proposing to remove is language that we originally proposed to insert. That was our language in the bill. The reason is not merely that that the requirement is imposed directly by federal law so that it's duplicative to reimpose it as a matter of state law, but in addition to that, the federal law is by its terms preemptive as to the labeling, and so you have a mishmash and an invitation for a challenge on that ground. So it's just we proposed the language originally. We want to see these warnings on there, but they will be mandated by federal law directly. That's why we're proposing to take it out.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
I think he's right. Actually, I don't think Oregon can impose separate labeling requirements even if we wanted to.
All right. I guess the committee seems to want to keep it in.
No. I mean, therefore, I'm saying I agree with him. I would remove it.
Okay. Senator Walker, where are you at?
Big Tobacco 1. I'll give him 16.
Senator Burdick, where are you?
Mr. Chair, I'll go over.
My will?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
That doesn't happen very often, Mr. Chair, really.
I noticed that. But Senator Starr.
I'll move the dash B-16 amendments.
All right. Senator Starr moves the dash B-16 amendments. Discussion beyond what we've already had. Any objections? Motion passes. Thank you. And let's see. Number 22.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the sunset on the funding aspects, and I think it would be helpful. I think the Tobacco Society, again, Tobacco Free Oregon, did ask for this, and I would ask, I think if we look at it,
Well, I think the issue here was, if I recall the discussion, people felt pretty strongly about this particular amendment on the committee, so I'm trying to keep my signals down here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think there was concern over the funding mechanism and that specifically the taking money out from prevention and
feeling
more comfortable.
Anybody out there want to wrestle the committee over this one? No? No. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the -B22 amendments.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves the -B22 amendments. House Bill 2368. Further discussion? Objections? There are none. Passed. All right. Shift to the B18 amendments. If I'm following my Captain Crunch decoding device.
You know, I used to eat that cereal. It's really sweet.
So we have the B18 and 23, if I understand correctly.
Yeah.
So if you consider the 18 and 23 used together.
18 and 23 together?
Right. So we've got the Cancer Society, Heart Association folks, and then we've got Marshall Coven Go Cross. You guys want to speak to these?
18.
Oh, these are the task force.
Yay, no, yep, yep.
Well, Mr. Chair, I brought up, before they do that, I brought this up when we were talking about 2094, and I asked Mr. Shepherd a question, and we decided to defer that question to 2368. Because I had concerns about setting up another task force and wondered if we could roll this into some kind of discussion about what we already have available. And I think Mr. Shepherd said that was something we could talk about in 2368. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Walker, yes, I do recall the discussion. I think your specific question was whether the any expenses associated with the task force could be paid out of the funds available, the funds provided in the bill for these enforcement efforts. And I don't, as constituted, I don't see the task force as having any significant fiscal impact, at least on DOJ.
Okay.
We would hope to, if the legislature makes a policy choice to form another task force or a task force to address these issues, the Attorney General would hope to participate, but we don't see that as imposing a fiscal cost for us.
There's no existing structure now to provide that oversight of the Master Settlement Agreement, which is what this task force is after.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there is not a specific body that's been constituted by the state that's expressly charged with guiding the state in aspects of the Master Settlement Agreement. In some of our discussions with the Cancer Society and Tobacco Free Coalition, there has been some discussion about whether an existing task force that deals with tobacco prevention efforts might undertake as part of its efforts some information gathering and recommendation function with respect to the Master Settlement Agreement. And I've indicated that we'd be happy to have anybody who would like to help us work on Master Settlement Agreement issues do that. But there isn't presently any body that has that mission other than the Attorney General's responsibility.
Senator Ringo.
I have this report you gave me relating to kids' tobacco, and it has a number of recommendations that aren't in any legislation I've seen. For example, prohibit the sale of cigarettes in packages and fewer than 20 cigarettes. And it just seems to me we've got good ideas here, and we're just not implementing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we certainly agree that there are lots of good ideas in the Attorney General's report on kids and tobacco. We had quite an aggressive and comprehensive legislative agenda that arose out of that, including the idea that you mentioned and last session, and we were just weren't successful with a number of those concepts.
Okay, well, just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I don't care one way or the other about the task force, but it seems to me that you really have a pretty good idea what kinds of things you need to do. And I'm not opposed to it.
All right. I think I'm going to move off the task force thing here real quick, because I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with it. I want to go to the B-24 amendments real quick. This is Jenny Burdick, Senator Burdick's amendment dealing with.
These are all getting mixed up,
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Would you like a little
explanation? Yes.
This actually came to us through national organization called Child Online Protective Services. This language currently appears in the statutes of Virginia and California, and there's a federal legislation pending to make it a national requirement, but that legislation hasn't moved through the process yet. What this would do is it's aimed at trying to prevent kids from using fake ID to get online and buy cigarettes. It wouldn't be perfect because there's always a ring around everything, but it would help to stop some of those sales, maybe even most of those sales, by requiring the seller, put the burden on the seller to verify the information that they're provided against a commercially available database of government-collected information showing the age or date of birth of the individual placing the order. So that could be a voter file, it could be a DMV record, it could be military records, something that shows the name and the age, that the burden would be on the seller to check before they sell the cigarettes. And then if you get to the enforcement provisions, and I'm kind of winging this part of it, but if you get to the enforcement provisions, I think it would make those provisions more enforceable because it's, you know, what is a good faith effort to show someone's age?
All right. Anybody out there want to speak to these amendments? Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nelson, representing R.J. Reynolds. First, I should make it clear, R.J. Reynolds doesn't sell on the Internet, so this amendment really doesn't affect them. But we have some concern in that the language that you are deleting, which is to require the individual to give some kind of a copy, photocopy of a valid, hopefully a valid driver's license in the purchase of that sale. It's my understanding that there is one company out there that sells this list, and that they have been promoting that amendment and the elimination of the other use, the other way of showing that you have a valid driver's license and you are someone who can purchase this. I would hate to be restricting through this amendment to only one vendor out there that is providing this certified list. Now, maybe there are other vendors, but when we looked at this amendment in the task force during this session, that was what came back to us was, you know, we thought it was fairly innocuous, that there is just, as I think, you know, Senator Burdick does, that there is a list out there that we can go to. But it appears that it is a particular vendor that has pushed this one approach. We believe that both approaches are correct, that, again, we don't sell on the Internet, but just looking at the how this would work systematically.
Okay. Senator Burdick?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that who vends and who doesn't is something probably outside the purview of this committee. I think what our purpose here is to make sure that no matter who does the checking or who provides the service, that the age and the name is matched with the same person. And, you know, if there's, I don't see any way that they could both be combined. I mean, I suppose we could change the amendment to say that they had to provide a photocopy and the seller had to check it against a you know, government database. I mean, I could see the rationale there. And that may be something that we'd want to do because this doesn't specifically say, with that deleted language, it doesn't specifically clarify that they have to provide a copy.
Okay. And are you willing to work with Mr. Nelson or whomever?
Yeah, as long as we're working in the direction of strengthening it, I'm happy to work. Is that something that...
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'd be happy to.
All right, so the B-24s, and we'll get hopefully some reporting of that to make people happy now. Let's move to the B-26 amendments. These are Senator Ringo's.
Mr. Chair, I had a meeting with a constituent that's active in tobacco education prevention programs, and she suggested this. And the rationale, I guess, is twofold. One is that cigarettes are subject to shoplifting, and it really is in the interest of everyone to prevent that. And one way is to place them behind the counter. The other thing is that in certain stores, they're marketed in a fashion that is very visible, and they're with visible displays, and that they ought to be put behind the counter. I mean, the convenience stores that I go into, they usually are behind the counter. And I guess I'm informed that there are ordinances in Oregon right now that require behind-the-counter sales of cigarettes. And so to me, this it doesn't seem too burdensome. I mentioned this to Mr. Nelson and Gardner, and they kind of expressed some ambivalence. I mentioned this to Pete Shepard, and he expressed to me, I mean, he thinks it's a great idea. He expressed to me some concern that it will receive the opposition of retailers. And therefore, we're treading into an area that will get some opposition. But he also gave me this report that I've been referring to. It's dated April 4th, 2001. It's the Attorney General's report, report and recommendations relating to kids and tobacco. And it lists five items, and number one on the item is enact a statewide ban on self-service tobacco product displays, require that a clerk assist the consumer in all tobacco transactions. So really, it's implementing what is the Attorney General's recommendation. And so that's what the B-26 is with you.
Right now, is there a, it doesn't appear to be a timeline for implementation. This would be immediate, I assume, upon passage?
I think upon effectiveness of the bill, and I don't know if this has an emergency clause or not.
Anybody out there from the retail establishment? Anybody wanting to speak to the issue?
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson, representing this case, 7-Eleven Corporation. We do, in all of our stores, as I indicated, Senator Ringo, do have all of the tobacco products behind the counter. In starting this whole process with the Attorney General and Department of Revenue, we all kind of laid out some ground rules, and one of those ground rules was we weren't going we were not going to venture off into other areas that were unrelated to the particular nature of these bills, both 2368 and 2094. I can say that this particular amendment brought very strong opposition from the Oregon Grocery Industry Association during the last session. We are very interested in passage of 2368. We would not like to see anything that would derail or slow that process down. And we understand where Senator Ringo is coming from. We, and I think the Department of Justice said today, great idea, but we believe it's the wrong bill.
I've heard this conversation before, Mr.
Chairman.
Others want to comment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Gardner, appearing for Philip Morris. This is a provision like this is actually on my list of proactive legislation objectives that they would like me to pursue, as are a number of others, which have greater or lesser degree of consensus within the industry and within the retail community. But I really concur with what Mark said. Our company thinks that this is a good idea. But the problem is there are a lot of folks, particularly smaller retailers and NFIBs and that kind of thing, who will not agree with that. And we think it's of paramount importance because of the crisis we confront to get this legislation through.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Richard Sosa-San, two different hats, one with the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, representing some of the small retailers throughout the state. And the first part, I think, if you look at some of the very, very small independent retailers located throughout Oregon, some will not have the physical space to move all the product behind the counter. That is an immediate concern. Aside from that, if you look at the retail community as a whole, in recent years, they're moving more and more and more towards this. So I think it's a self-policing situation that, with minor exceptions, the industry itself is heading in that direction. I think in terms of other retailers, you will see some that would carry a wide variety of product, and if we would face a situation like this, you would limit the product availability in the store. Again, I think you disenfranchise certain segments and certain store owners. And as echoed by Mr. Nelson and Mr. Gardner, in light of the effort and I think the significance of the underlying legislation, I would prefer that this not be pursued in this bill.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I really like this amendment. And, you know, we have a process in this building to, when something's holding up a bill, we have ways to deal with that. I would really like to pursue this amendment. I think when you look at some of the displays that just go out of their way to be attractive things, and you look at the problem you have with youth smoking, and studies have shown if you can get people to the age of 20 or 21 without smoking, chances are they won't be smokers. So it's if we can stop these attractive displays, I think that's very much in line with the subject area of this bill, and I think it's very clear that this bill is going to get through this process. And I would be more than willing to help it get through with a positive amendment like this.
You know, we don't have the some of the retailers that I think were mentioned that would oppose it, but that doesn't necessarily bother me. Senator Rego, what would you think of having a date out in the future that would be an implementation date so that people don't have a sticker shock issue?
I'm fine with that.
I think I could support the amendment if there was a period of time that would be demonstrated to be reasonable for retailers to comply with the statute. But right now, having it embedded in the bill, then having opposition creates a problem. But I think if there's a phase-in period or something, a timeline to it, so the educator have that knowledge, I think that might be more defensive.
What kind of timeline do you
think? I don't know.
I hear it's 9 months a year.
Yeah.
The bill
itself doesn't go into effect until January.
January 4th.
So if you gave...
Unless, do we have an emergency clause provision anywhere?
No.
Saying, oh,
no.
Okay.
I looked. There's one clause in the back that says... No, it just says on or after January 1.
Okay.
So
you can give an extra 6 months.
July?
9 months. Richard, you're looking eager. You're just moving up front here for a better seat.
Oh,
okay. Well, why don't we work on a time line for an amendment drafted that has an implementation date that has a reasonable time period.
Okay, but just for guidance, I mean, I would think a year is reasonable. Can we just say June 1st of 2004?
July, please.
Do you like July?
I don't know why. I just like July.
You like July?
Yeah, I think I've been a bit now.
Of what year? Of 2004? Cool. Well, and we'll come back with the amendment, and that'll give the other opposition and people to kind of scream and yell and contort and all kinds of weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll find out where it is. Center. Start. If you have a different opinion on this issue, I
like the idea.
Good.
All right.
All in agreement. Do you know? Does anyone know if they still sell cigarettes and vending machines that are accessible to children?
I think there are such a thing, but
vending
okay.
machines.
No more.
No restaurants.
Bars and taverns.
Where children shouldn't be anywhere. Okay.
Unless they're dancing, right? That's a different story.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that.
That's right.
Well, that's another issue I'd like to see in a bill. Anyway, we're going to adjourn for the day. But what I would like to do before we adjourn is get the direction. We'll get the amendments that we have adopted so far. We'll turn to the Buckingham for us so we can look at the bill. And get the other outstanding issues. On the task force issue, you guys need to come yak at me a little bit about that, whether it's something you want to pursue or not. Not looking too excited, but anyway, we're going to adjourn.